Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your sinister marketing corporation of music news and journalism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Never thought you'd hear the day where an Arcade Fire song would be opening up the podcast, and yet here we are, an Arcade Fire song opening up the podcast. That is Everything Now, which is the title track from Everything Now, which is the new Arcade Fire record, which came out last week and is very divisive, especially for people who are fanatical about Arcade Fire. I wanted to talk and go deep a little bit about this record and also where Arcade Fire is in the sort of arc of its career. And on top of that, the rollout of this album was peculiar, to say the least. So to tackle all of these very, very pregnant topics, I've got on the phone, live from Columbus, Ohio, I've got Chris DeVille, who is the senior news editor from Stereo Gum. What's good, Chris?
Hey, what's good?
Thank you for being here. I have you on not just because I admire your work, and it's very thorough and very thoughtful, but also I feel like the arc of the rollout of this Arcade Fire album, I feel like it couldn't have happened without you specifically. You and Stereo Gum have become sort of characters in the rollout a little bit. Is that fair to say?
I think it's definitely fair to say, for better or for worse.
Right. Yes. No value judgment, or at least not yet. We have many minutes to go. But for now, no value judgment. Let's just do like a top line thing. Where do you feel this record fits in Arcade Fire's oeuvre? One thing that you said in your review is that it's its most, I believe the phrase was, musically inessential. I'm always down for an inessential music takedown. But talk to me about where this belongs in sort of the bigger picture of Arcade Fire and how they arrived at this.
Back in 2004, you've got Arcade Fire kind of like exploding onto the indie rock scene, the super enthusiastic, earnest, kind of like an arena rock band posing as an indie rock band.
Yes, and exploding is the right terminology there. Like, they were, it was clangorous at the time.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I remember the most about seeing them at CMJ that first year when they were releasing their debut album was
R.I.P. CMJ.
Two of the members, like, pounding each other on the heads while they were wearing helmets and drumming on each other's heads. That was like, you know, a big part of the live show back then.
Who are they?
Like
Melt Banana? Energy. What's going on?
Yeah.
But they were loud. And I remember, yes, and that tension, that was an interesting moment because we're sort of just past like the New York rock revival, right? So we're sort of like still in that guitar rock is cool moment. And here's a band that was like, we're going to take the sort of the diffidence of that and kind of upend it and actually kind of sneak these grand ambitions in to the space.
Right. And I mean, I would argue that at that time they were doing that exceptionally well.
Yeah.
I'm definitely a stan for Funeral, their debut album. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it seems like, you know, they caught on quite a bit. They built this big audience. They got a lot of, you know, celebrity co-signs, David Bowie and all that. And so then they, you know, kind of with each subsequent album got more and more ambitious in terms of making these grand statements and trying to create, you know, kind of be the definitive arena rock band of their time.
Right. But coming with from that sensibility, like coming from a smaller sense of original scene and sensibility, but still kind of committed to, you know, theatrics that we would normally associate with like a U2 ultimately, you know, by the second or third record.
By the third record, they were playing arenas and they ended up kind of in an upset winning the Grammy for album of the year.
Oh, I'd almost kind of block that from my memory. God, that was like a weird, that's like a suppressed trauma of mine. I guess I have to unpack that in therapy this week.
Yeah.
That did happen. I'm now remembering them going on the stage and looking very confused and sort of like, how did we get here? And what does it mean? And like, let's everybody play a song because that's more meaningful than this. That's more or less what happened, right?
They played one of their more punk rock type songs after accepting the award. And then 4 years ago, 2013, they came back with Reflector, their fourth album, which seemed like a response to some criticisms that they didn't have enough swing and rhythm, and they were just kind of like perilously white.
Right, which is, I mean, depending on your angle, it's either a criticism or a fact. And of course, and it's worth saying, like, Arcade Fire is not an entirely white band. Like, you know, like, you have one of the vocalists is not white. But the musical structures, you know, did not really, up until Reflector. Reflector is the one that has the sort of the Haitian, the compa music on it.
Right.
Yeah. So that reference stuff doesn't appear really anywhere on the first three records.
Well, I mean, there's a song on the very first record called Haiti that, you know, I guess kind of
alludes to it.
Yeah. But it's not like this. It really comes in a huge way on Reflector. And then they got James Murphy from LCD Sound System involved. And it was very much like, it was the most radical kind of creative reboot of their career so far. And at the same time, you know, this is a band who at this point is headlining arenas, won the Grammy for Album of the Year, but they were still seeing themselves as kind of like these indie rock underdogs.
Let's listen to something from Reflector. Let's listen to the title track, and you hear the beginning of the Arcade Fire reboot in here. Okay, so to that point that you were just talking about, Chris, do you get the sense that the reboot of Reflector is, for lack of a better phrase, an organic evolution of a band, or a band, like you said earlier, responding to criticism and proving it could do something other than what it had previously done?
I mean, it's hard to judge their motives that much. I mean, obviously, like you said, I already did.
it's a safe space, Chris. Speak your heart. Speak whatever you feel. I felt like it was Craven. Here, I'll start. I felt like it was Craven. So I'll start with that. So then, you know, say go wherever you want to go from there.
I wouldn't go so far as to call it Craven. It definitely seemed guided by the criticisms that they'd received.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, it's like they'd taken the thing that they did to a certain extreme, and I'm not sure they could have kept doing that thing.
Right, over and
like
over
again. Their signature thing.
Pretty sure, if I'm remembering correctly, in your review of the new record, you sort of talk about this time period and likened it to the U2 kind of like pop Zeuropa era.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that even more so this new album, Everything Now, fits that parallel. But at the time of Reflector, they also got really into kind of all this extracurricular album rollout promotion type stuff, where it's like they created this alternate Instagram account and this alternate identity of, that they were the Reflectors. And there's all this guerrilla marketing. And this was at a time kind of before Beyonce kind of initiated the surprise album trend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rollouts had kind of exploded that year that Reflector came out. And it was like this, you know, how ostentatious can you get in your album rollout?
Right. Not just as marketing, but also as commentary. You know, it's both
right,
of those
like
things.
Part of your creative package that you're presenting.
Right. Is that you're kind of like ironically, I don't know, like stuff like that always tends to run me the wrong way. Like it's a little, it's like too smart by half and like a little mm-hmm. too cute. And I feel like there are probably good examples of it that I'm not thinking of right now that don't draw attention to themselves the way Arcade Fire tends to draw attention to itself. And so, especially if we like jump forward to like this current rollout, to me, it was just like full of red flags. I don't know. I'm like not that personally sympathetic to people who are just like, you know, capitalism is this and then, but we're going to totally participate in it and we're going to make fun of it while we're participating. Like I'm personally unsympathetic to that, but it did feel like, and it felt like on this album rollout, there was a lot of that. There were a lot of things, whether it was the t-shirts or like the Twitter thing, everything was kind of like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Right.
Yeah, it was like their whole ethos this time was that like performative irony and are we serious or are we not serious?
Right, but it's like not the 60s, you know. It's like, right. Like they didn't invent irony, you know.
And I mean, I would argue, and you know, I have argued that it's not a good look for them. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, there are artists that pull it off better than they do, but they're just the thing that was so refreshing about them when they first emerged was that they were, you know, they had their heart on their sleeves and they were howling away mm-hmm. and it was like they weren't afraid to be, you know, to communicate genuine emotion in an underground that, you know, at the time when they were coming out, emo, it's never exactly been cool, but, you know, we had our emo revival a few years ago.
Right, right. So, but it wasn't in that time period. It wasn't in that sort of milieu. Like, their milieu was like a cool milieu, like a kind of like almost like uninterested, like hands-off emotion kind of space.
Right.
And that's not what they were doing.
For a band like that, who does everything in these big, almost clumsy, broad strokes, well, they get clumsier the more they try to kind of cut against that earnestness with this whole shtick.
Yeah.
So, yeah, now we've got, you know, 4 years after Reflector, they come back with this album that is kind of like the rollout is everything that Reflector did kind of exponentially amplified in your face. And it was a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. And also, so let's do this. Let's talk about the music first, and then let's get to the rollout and kind of like the stereo gum, stereo yum meta narrative that's going on there. But I guess I can't talk about the music without talking about Wynn Butler's response to some of the criticism. And one thing that I found particularly funny, and I think you guys just did like a little news item about it, was how frustrated he was that people said that he was rapping on this mm-hmm. album. And I thought that was funny because when I heard the song that people are talking about, the first thing I heard, I mean, it's not like I'm thinking of Jay-Z, but like I'm thinking of like Blondie's Rapture. It reminds me a lot of that. You know, it's rapping and so much of that is rapping. So let's play this section of Signs of Life, which is about half or two thirds of the way through, where Wynn Butler is, I'm just going to say it, he's rapping. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, sometimes Sunday. Love is hard, sex is easy. God in heaven, could you please me? You think you invented life? You find it hard to define, but you do it every time. Then you do it again. Looking for signs of life, looking for signs every night, but there's no signs of life. So there you have it. Sorry, Wynn. That's, I don't know, it's rappy. It's something. I thought it was the reaction to it was strange because obviously he's clearly trying to engage with how his vocal, like from a rhythmic perspective, he's clearly trying to do things with his vocals that he has not done on previous Arcade Fire records.
Right.
So, and it, I understand that, you know, you call something rapping, there's, you're racially codifying it and you're, you know, classic, like all these codifications start coming. But also, if you're speaking in rhythm, that's kind of sort of half of what that is.
Right.
So I was a little surprised. I was like, you protesting a little much there, my guy. You know?
Yeah, I was, I mean, it seemed like he was seizing on that criticism in particular, which wasn't even necessarily a criticism.
No, it's not. It's like literally a description. Yeah, it's a description.
There were a lot of critiques leveled at this album, and I thought it was surprising that, maybe not surprising, rather than kind of dialogue with what people are actually complaining about, it's almost like a red herring.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's right, because it's easier to sort of quibble over a minor fact, basically, or descriptor, than it is to quibble or to quarrel even with someone who's like, I just don't like this. This is just not good.
Right.
So that's actually, that's a good point, I think. So bigger picture, how would you describe this album, and especially vis-a-vis the previous Arcade Fire record?
The previous one, Reflector, they definitely went dance, but it wasn't like every single song on the album was a dance song. They had a few different styles. They had some like more straightforward rock and roll songs, and it was just super long, lots of different conceptual things going on, and it was a lot to take in. So now everything now is, as an album, is like slightly pared down version of that. You have kind of a string of dancier songs. You got your ABBA type song, which was, you know, we already heard the title track. You got Signs of Life, which is kind of like a funky rap oriented song. You got
rap
Creature Comfort.
Don't worry, Wynn. It's just rap oriented. Don't stress.
Yeah, yeah. I'll put a few more qualifiers on it for him. And then, you know, you got Creature Comfort, which is one of the better songs on the album, in my opinion, because it captures some of that old energy, kind of a synth pop song delivered with like kind of a scrappy punk rock. I don't know if punk rock is the right word for it. It reminded me of Times New Viking. Columbus. Shout out to my fellow Columbus.
Yeah, should we shout out the whole Columbus crew while we have you on the phone? Let's shout out Rob Harvilla. Let's shout out Hanif. Y'all just had a squad out there.
I know. We never hang out though.
Really? Is that right? Y'all don't. What is there like is there like a donut shop y'all should go to or what?
I mean, you know, we see each other at shows, but yeah, I'm always like at my house doing dad stuff.
And Rob too. I know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, someday I'll come to Columbus and we'll convene the forces and we'll all build.
Yes, we can definitely build. So we got, we got our like dancey songs up front, and then they kind of do this weird. I mean, they definitely get more experimental in the middle. They've got this like kind of attempt at a dub song.
So let's listen to a little bit of that. Let's listen to Peter Pan. We'll be back in a sec.
All right, so we just heard the Peter Pan there, kind of attempted a dub song, and then they've got Chemistry, which people have compared to Billy Squier a lot. It reminded me of Sleigh Bells.
Yeah, like I'd be much more stressed about being compared to Billy Squier than to rap, but you know, that's just me.
That's like a pretty perilous stretch of the album. You got a punk rock song called Infinite Content. You got a reprise of that same song that's like a country version of it. And the end of the album is probably the best part, when Butler's wife, Regine, she sings lead usually one or two songs per album, and her song Electric Blue, one of the better ones on the album. It's one of the more successful dance songs as well.
Mm-hmm.
That one reminded me of Blondie a little bit, maybe late 70s Bowie.
And let's talk a little bit about the idea of them making dance records, right? So on the last album, they worked with James Murphy from LCD. On this album, they worked with one of the Daft Punk guys, right?
Yes, Thomas Bangalter.
Yeah, Bangalter, right.
Steve Mackey from Pulp is in there. Marcus Droves, who I'm pretty sure Marcus Droves is still in there. He did work on Reflector, and he's done Coldplay and Mumford & Sons and that kind of arena rock stuff.
Okay, so this is where I'm going to give my hot take on this record.
I'm ready.
Yes, but umbrella hot take, which is, I was texting with Karen Gantz, our pop music editor, about this album, and I was like, this sounds like a 303 record to me.
That is, I mean, even in this context, that's pretty piping hot.
That's how I feel. Like, and I wasn't trying to be provocative. I was trying to be funny, maybe, but I wasn't trying to be provocative. Like, I think the problem with the way that this record has been assessed is that, and it's just part of, it's baked into the Arcade Fire proposition, which is, we're a smart band. We're an earnest band. We're a grand band. Like, we are all of these things. And the way that you should engage with our music is through those lenses. And on the last album, and especially on this record, I was like, as a dumb record, this is okay. I'm not mad at this as a dumb record. The problem is if you start to expect it to be something other than that. And like, here's the thing, like, Win Butler to me is not a great lyricist. I don't feel like the lyrics are particularly impressive on any of the records, but especially not this one. And so I'm like, if you choose to look at this record, not as a dumb record made by a smart band, but rather just a kind of like cool record made by a neither smart nor dumb band, then maybe it's okay. And when I call it a 303 record, I do not mean that as an insult. So it's strange to arrive at an Arcade Fire record that I wouldn't go so far as to say I really enjoy it, but I kind of don't have the disdain for it that I maybe had for some of the early stuff. And it's strange to arrive at that, and to arrive at that, especially through the lens of basically being like, this is kind of like sort of punky and sort of dancey and like a little bit hip hop. And that's an Arcade Fire. I think if this came in the mail anonymously and I didn't know what band it was, I would probably assume it was like one of those like Fueled by Ramen, smart Fueled by Ramen band, you know?
I can see that. That makes sense.
Yes. I mean, I understand it's a little bit of a conceptual leap, but I felt like the only way I felt comfortable really talking about this record was outside of the sort of very heavy, heavy cloud of talking about Arcade Fire. Because talking about Arcade Fire kind of comes with all this baggage. But when I listened to the record and tried to listen to the songs on their own, I was like, oh, if this came from a fun band, people would probably like it.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, it is hard to separate both the history of the band and the current context they're building up around themselves from the music. And maybe later in time, we'll be able to go back and separate those things and just listen to it as music, but
you can't do it, right? It's very hard to do right now, and that's why, like, even just me saying that, I'm sure people will be mad and say insulting things on Twitter, but it's like, it's whatever, that's what we do, that's the job. But part of the reason, especially with Arcade Fire, why it's hard to divorce music from positioning is because they are so aggressive about positioning. So let's talk a little bit about the rollout of this record. And let's step one step back, which is to explain to those of our listeners who may not know, Stereogum, the website that you are employed by, has a recurring feature, which is called premature evaluation. Can you explain to the people what that is and why that exists?
Okay, so premature evaluation it's basically an album review. It originated back when Stereogum was kind of on the wild frontier of MP3 blogs. And it was like when an album would leak, Stereogum would review it like right away with a premature evaluation. And that was the whole idea. It was like, here's where you come to the comment section and work out your thoughts in real time.
And it was also sort of ultimately probably an earnest realignment of kind of what critical culture had become. Because obviously people will have opinions from the very second that something comes out. But I felt like when you guys did that, it was an acceptance of the fact that, like, we understand that the pressures of the internet demand this kind of content. We also understand that we, as thoughtful critics, don't necessarily feel that we can define our response to a record in 3 hours or whatever it is. So we're going to create this middle category where we admit and that it's not final.
It's evolved to a certain extent, though, because there are sometimes when, like, you know, Jay-Z a few weeks ago, Tom Bryan sat around like the day of it came out writing about it, and it was kind of a classic premature evaluation. But then sometimes, as is the case with Arcade Fire, you know, we have a promo of the album and we're not, you know, we're a little bit, we're kind of playing by the rules of the system more now, where we're not just going to review something because it leaked.
Right.
So
shouts to Tom B, though. Shouts to Tom B, always.
Oh, yeah.
Always.
You should have him on here again sometime.
Tom B, right, in 2000, probably in the time that you and I have talked, has probably written 2,000 words about something.
It's insane how fast he writes.
What a beast.
Yeah, so we have premature evaluations.
And in the case of this record, how did you guys roll that out? Did you do it on the day the promo arrived, or what was the context for that?
We got to go back to the beginning of the whole rollout. So Arcade Fire released Everything Now, the title track from the album. You know, they had been hyping up for a couple of days, we're going to announce something or release something, or at least they were doing kind of promotional things that suggested they were going to announce something. So they released the song, and it's like this disco song that, in my opinion, doesn't really have a hook. And I already was kind of like blasé about Reflector, and I hear Everything Now, and I'm even less impressed. And they had also released this like political song with Mavis Staples at the beginning of the year that I thought was really awful. And so I, as like a disgruntled fan, I start off, we were like, let's do an essay about the first single they released, kind of like an instant reaction thing. Not technically in the premature evaluation category because we reserved
it
for album.
But it was a take. And what was the title of it? Because I can't quite remember at the moment.
Remember When Arcade Fire Were Good.
Love it. Good internet. Good internet headline. Good internet.
Yes, it was very well-read.
I bet.
Piece of criticism. And, you know, I said in that piece basically like they were just being propped up by their reputation, and they were at a point like U2 or the Rolling Stones or Weezer or the Strokes where it's like their best music is behind them, but people are still going to pay attention to it anyway. And they responded to that by purchasing ads on Stereo Gum that promoted the album and quoted that review out of context. Like when you see a movie poster that has a little snippet from the bad review, but they make it sound like it's a good review.
Yeah, just like Fox and Friends advertised on the New York Times with a snippet from Jim's review. Like, you know, I get it. I know what the game is made of.
Right, and I mean, it was like a way to troll us, basically. And I thought it was funny. We did a post, like, touche, Arcade Fire. And I kind of thought that would be the end of it. But then before we published our actual premature evaluation, like the week before, Arcade Fire created a fake website made to look like Stereo Gum called Stereo Yum and published a premature evaluation where they were basically like kind of preemptively trying to anticipate what the review was going to say. And it was kind of like intended as a critique of hot take journalism and a critique of Stereo Gum in particular.
Right. And now, of course, I have been occasionally maligned, you know, by an artist I have negatively critiqued. Like, these things happen, you know? Everyone's sensitive about their product. I'm sure I'd be sensitive, you know, were I ever being critiqued in the fashion that musicians are. I get that. It did feel like a little whiny. It was like a little Ryan Adamsy, you know? Like, it was a little whiny. I guess, like, I assume they thought it was funny or wry. I can't quite tell what the intention was, like whether the intention was a wink or whether the intention was a middle finger. Like, do you kind of have a vibe on what you think the intention was?
I had a hard time sussing out whether it was supposed to be just a joke or whether we at Stereo Gum were supposed to look dumb, whether they were trying to prevent us from saying some of the things that we were going to say by saying them first. I'm not really sure, again, what their intention was, but I didn't think it was that funny. I was mostly annoyed by it.
And that came at a time where there was also, like, it was right around the time where there was also the stuff that was going on about the dress code for the concert, and then they were like, there's no dress code. There was a lot of kind of, like, I don't want to say hide and seek, but, like, they were baking in uncertainty into the rollout. It's like,
yeah,
we have this show and there's dress code, but there's not. And we're going to create a website that looks like Stereo Gum, but it's not. And my gut is like, if you really think your record is strong and really about it, you don't spend time doing stuff like this. That's like my gut. Can you explain also the Twitter thing that they did, like with the Twitter conversing the bot?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, when they were teasing the record, all of the teases came from like these Russian spam bot Twitter accounts kind of playing on the whole fake news, you know, Russian interference, all that. And then they later launched Everything Now Corporation Twitter account that was basically like this satirical, very heavy-handed satire of a corporate account that was supposed to be like kind of Arcade Fire's corporate representative, and it was bantering back and forth with the band's account and bantering back and forth with brands like KFC and Coca-Cola. And I don't know whether they contacted the people from those brands or if the social media people at KFC just like picked up on it or what. But so they had this whole elaborate social media parody thing.
I don't know. It's just hard to, it's like literally like interacting with brands on Twitter would like stop being cool 3 years ago. You know, it's
right.
Like, it's not a cool thing. Like, it's not funny. I don't know. I don't know to whom it's funny anymore. I guess that's, and that's sort of why I'm like kind of baffled that not only is it part of a thing that this band is doing, but also that it's like so integral somehow to the rollout. Also, I got earlier today, before I left the house to come into the office, I checked my mail and I had the physical copy of the Arcade Fire record showed up. I don't know if you've seen the physical copy yet.
I have not.
So there's just like on the outer casing of the record, there are like all these corporate logos. They're nonsense corporations and they're nothing corporations, but there are all these logos. And I'm just like, I don't know, like Mr. Robot, like what are we, Mr. Robot, Black Mirror? Like, I don't know. It just all feels very 3 years ago to me. And I found it like a distraction. And again, a distraction from a record that I think is probably most interesting and best appreciated from an anti-intellectual or at least not fully brainy perspective. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I even thought if they would have just dropped the whole album by surprise with no rollout, that it would have been fairly well received.
Totally agree. Totally
like,
agree.
Even the singles that they released, the dancey ones that are at the front of the album, they released them all as singles. And it's like they sound better grouped together on the album than they do as these standalone singles. And when you're not like listening to them with the pressure of like, this is the lead single on Arcade Fire's new album, it's still not the most amazing thing I've ever heard, but it's not so in your face, like exhausting.
Yes, I agree. Look, I don't know what it's like to be in a band that feels like it has to rewrite its arc, you know, like three albums in or four albums in, and especially one that is so kind of like unpacked and critiqued kind of in every gesture. Like, that's got to be frustrating. So I try to be a little bit sympathetic. But at the same time, I think it'd be very funny if the sort of endpoint takeaway of the entire Arcade Fire narrative, like the 14 or 13 years of Arcade Fire, is that they just end up as like a pop punk band. So with that in mind, let's maybe go out on one of the maybe more fun songs with a little bit of good cheer from Arcade Fire. Let's listen to Electric Blue. Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thank you to my guest, Chris DeVille. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us and tell us where Arcade Fire went wrong or maybe even went right at podcast@nytimes.com. Please subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, I think, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. We are back next week.